I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. About a month ago, we had John Meacham on the program, and he's always a wonderful guest. During the course of the conversation, he said, you need to interview Nancy Eisenberg. Her book is coming out in paperback, and it's really good. And so I take that recommendation and wholeheartedly agree with him, and I'm happy that he recommended that she be on this show. The book has just been published in paperback. It's White Trash, the 400-year-old untold history of class in America. Nancy says the book is, reviewers have said, it's a gritty and sprawling assault on this aspect of American myth-making, that upward mobility is possible. Ours is a very class-based society, had been long before Occupy Wall Street or Bernie Sanders, long before we were a country really at all. And a lot of this has to do with trying to understand what was going on in this country during the 2016 campaign and the subsequent election of Donald Trump, who he is, who the people are that he has been enthusiastically supported by and continues to be as well, although we will ask Nancy if there is a disconnect, a growing disconnect between those promises that he's made and how he has governed, or if indeed people will just stick by him. She cites an 81-year-old man from Florida, from finding actually somebody in a piece recently asked Trump voters, Washington Post it was, asked Trump voters, are you still happy with him several months into office or not, and got a lot of different answers. An 81-year-old man from Florida, maybe cut down on Twitters and keep your head up. You're doing fine. Think before you speak. Don't talk too much. But a lot of support still expressed for Donald Trump. So we will talk about that. And we'll look at this whole issue of class in America with our guest. And welcome your phone calls as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter, and that Twitter address is @KDunnShow. Nancy is the author of the aforementioned book. She's also the author of Fallen Founder, The Life of Aaron Burr, and co-author of Madison and Jefferson. She's the Harry Williams Professor of American History at Louisiana State University. She writes regularly for Salon.com and is the winner of many awards for her writing. And so that's that. Let's talk to her. Hello, Nancy. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello. How are you? I forgot to mention that I got my PhD at the University of Wisconsin at Madison.
Oh, my gosh. Another one who's made it to the top, got the PhD in Madison. So many guests have. I'm glad to hear that. Well, you must be happy to know, and I must tell you that John Meacham just sung your praises to the point where we got off the air and I said, we got to have Nancy on the show. He just really loved your book. So that's good for you to know, I'm sure.
Well, I have met him before. Because the Madison and Jefferson book was also published at Random House when he was working there, and he was also at a conference about Jefferson that I went to. So, yes, it's nice to hear that that anyone is saying that your book is worth reading.
Right, and it's good for him to say that. All right, let's talk about Donald Trump. Donald Trump, you write in the preface, I think, to the paperback of the book, succeeded in confounding so many smart people. What was the attraction to this loud, endlessly self-promoting New Yorker?
Yeah, and I think we have to look at this question in a more complicated way. And I know that often doesn't work on TV or sound bites, but in radio, I think we can go a little bit more.
We sure can.
I think one of the things people forget, because there were, you know, pundits are looking for quick and easy answers. So one of the responses that I addressed was that people thought it was, you know, surging class issues had replaced identity politics. And I took that idea to task because the problem is we've always had identity politics in this country. And this is one of the things I write about. I talk about the way in which class was used and redefined our political system, particularly through the candidacy of Andrew Jackson, by presenting him and the way in which his handlers, and he did have handlers, he even had the first ghost-written campaign biography, presented him as a symbol of the common man, a symbol of the working stiff. This rhetoric has a really long history, and it's something that Trump himself took advantage of. I mean, every time he got before a crowd, put on his red Bubba cap, and claimed to be sort of stepping down from his penthouse, he was making that gesture, which we demand of our politicians, that they act like us.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with that, we demand that of them at the same time we expect we have gross inequality in our country. And it's not only the 1%, but this is a long-standing pattern. We expect a kind of stage performance of our politicians, that they come down to our level. And I root that all the way back to early 19th century democracy. And this is one of the things we have to understand about Trump. He borrowed slogans. He borrowed elements that came from previous candidates. He's not simply something which the media always wants to say, oh, this is brand new, this is sort of horrible. But in fact, we have to put it in historical perspective and stop assuming that, you know, Trump's success really is merely a product of reality TV. That's just one piece of the puzzle.
Another piece of the puzzle that's sort of hard for me to understand, Nancy, is you talk about other presidents like Bill Clinton, who had this Southern thing going for him, the blue suede shoes, the accent, humble beginnings, etc. Also, you mentioned Jimmy Carter, you know, who could have been a level above a white trash kind of background, even mentioned that. And now you have somebody like Donald Trump, who is, you know, a New Yorker, for heaven's sake. I mean, he sort of speaks the game. He sort of speaks the language of people who are hurting. But holy Toledo, he is so far from the misery that people are facing day by day. I never could understand how people could embrace his billionaire status, his flashy gold apartments, et cetera.
Right. I mean, Carter, first of all, you mentioned Carter. Carter actually came from an upper middle-class family. I mean, he grew up with a tennis court in the backyard. He, in a sense, it became political because he marketed himself. I mean, he was running against another Democrat, and there was a runoff race, and he had to portray himself as not belonging to the country club. And then he circulated pictures of himself riding on a tractor. Part of the problem that I do highlight in the preface is this idea that we are often not voting for the real person. We are voting for this embodied appeal.
Mm-hmm.
We're voting, and this is the thing that I think most Americans would like to believe, that we vote our self-interest, that we're sensible enough to understand the policies. But if you look at all the research shows that people often don't know which policies the candidates stand for. They often are voting in a very emotional way. And the stage performance is really important, because all the people who were interviewed who voted for Trump said he spoke with a raw honesty. And language is so important during campaigns. Not only is the person defined by the news and video clips and the zingers and the particular image that they project, but it also comes down to this imagined bond that the voter has with a candidate. And they can latch on to anything. And Trump, with his class identity, he played it both ways. At times, you know, he liked to call himself classy. people who are more snobbish, they would say, oh, you know, he's crass, he's a symbol of the nouveau riche. And then other times he would make claims that he was a self-made man. And it didn't matter how many times the fact checkers proved him wrong or pointed out that he inherited money from his father. The point is that people are responding to what he says. They're responding to something that they found in him that seemed more real and authentic, you know, authentic, that defied all the facts. And this is one of the things that another scholar who's coming out with a book called The Broken Ladder has highlighted. This emotional, psychological way that people often misinterpret the world they're in. They project things onto candidates that they may not necessarily represent, but they're so desperate. I mean, I think this is the other thing. What we saw is that many voters were so desperate.
Right.
They were sick. They'd been told over and over again that Washington's corrupt. Trump claimed he was cleaning out the swamp, and that goes all the way back to Andrew Jackson, believe it or not. But they so desperately wanted someone who they imagined was going to represent their interests. And that's the one thing Trump did do. He brought media attention to rural white Americans. He brought media attention to certain working class issues. But there's never any guarantee that that person is going to follow through on any of that.
And what's interesting is you talk about representing interests, that this these people, the white kind of rural outcasts, go way back. Talk about vilifying people and not even thinking them as human beings. I mean, you take us way back to George Washington, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, I take it back even farther. I take it back to the 1500s and British colonization. And this is sort of the side of American history that we don't like to talk about. I mean, and this is the other thing. Most Americans don't know their history. And what they do know is probably what they learned in grade school, maybe high school. They might know about the Pilgrims. They might know about Pocahontas. But usually what they know about history is the patriotic story. I mean, why do you think Hamilton is so popular?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's an upbeat, celebratory story which turns Alexander Hamilton into a self-made immigrant. That wasn't the real Hamilton, but everyone loves the story. We love the upbeat story about America, that we are the land of opportunity, that we are the land of social mobility. But the facts and the evidence disprove that again and again. The people who the British imagined were going to people North America were what they referred to as the waste people.
Mm-hmm.
These are people who were a burden on the British economy. They were people who were criminals who were sent overseas. And they also were people who, you know, were suffering from incredible debts who went here. And that was the majority. The majority of people who came to this country would fall into the category of unfree. Not only slaves, but indentured servants. Indentured servitude, most people wouldn't even live through their period of servitude. It could go from anywhere from 7 to 9 years.
Goodness.
And one of the most exploited groups in the 18th century, from the 1600s, to well into the 19th century were children. And that's another thing we have to remember. We had child labor in this country until 1919. So we have to kind of look at all the history that we don't want to acknowledge. We have a lot of class tensions, and they either get ignored or they're going to come out in very disruptive ways and not necessarily productive ways. And that's the kind of tension I try to cover in my book, both the myth-making, what we try to hide, the class reality, and then at the other time, where if we look closely at our past, Americans in the past have been very blatant about defending class hierarchy, defending the old English idea of pedigree, that in a sense, not only you were born to your station, but you inherit your position.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what led to the widespread popularity of the eugenics movement.
Mm-hmm.
So old class ways of thinking, not only are they part of our past, but they're a part of our present. Right now, sociologists have found in 2015 the best predictor of whether you're going to be really successful in this country is the wealth and privilege you inherit from your parents.
That's amazing.
And that's a class reality that's reproduced every day by families that we never talk about.
Yeah. So who was it espousing the idea? Was it George Washington, considering importing German immigrants to the colonies, hoping to improve the work ethic and the breeding stock of farmers and laborers? Who came up with that idea?
Yeah, that was actually Thomas Jefferson.
Was
that
it?
I have a whole chapter on Jefferson. I have a whole chapter on Franklin, because they are really important intellectuals, ideologues, and a lot of their assumptions have stayed with us. But the reason that Thomas Jefferson is such a complicated figure, many people like to celebrate him as if he worshipped the yeoman farmer. The yeoman farmer was supposed to be, you know, our equivalent of the middle-class American. But as scholars have shown, yeoman farmers in his period and particularly into the 19th century, what we think of middle class, to make it as a farmer in Virginia, you had to inherit slaves. And often that meant that you were inheriting them from your family members. And Jefferson himself preferred terms like the husbandman, the cultivator, and he really believed that the key to virtue was that people had to work the soil, that they had to be farmers, that they had to find a way that this is what would make America great, was an attachment to the soil. And he even believed it was the source of patriotism. But he also had a lot of ideas about, well, how do we deal with slavery? How do we deal with the poor? Because when he wrote the Declaration of Independence, 40% of the population in Virginia were landless tenant farmers. That means they didn't own slaves, and they didn't own land, and they couldn't vote. So one of his schemes was this idea that he, when he was trying to think about, well, how do we deal with slavery? And he had a variety of different arguments. But one of them was he was going to import German workers, and he was going to put them side by side, and that if, you know, slaves went through this apprenticeship, they would see the hardworking Germans and learn from their example, and that somehow that would make it possible to allow them to be freed. But, you know, this is an old idea. It's an old idea of emulation. And the Germans, I mean, the same way Jefferson praised them as hardworking, Benjamin Franklin despised the Germans. And I grew up in Pennsylvania. I mean, my family grew up in Pennsylvania. And the Germans, because they were a very large immigrant group, Franklin disliked them because they wouldn't learn English, they wouldn't be assimilated into society. So you have all these old stereotypes about how we look at immigrants. Who do we think is more valuable? And the whole problem that when Franklin and Jefferson talked about social mobility, they talked about the size of the continent. It was all linked to westward expansion. And therefore, they never promised upward mobility. What they promised was horizontal mobility. And this idea, sadly enough, is still being used today. Kevin Williamson of the National Review attacked Trump supporters, basically said, well, if you're living in dying communities, you just pack your bags and move. And this is that old English idea. The poor have to be dumped somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're not making it, move on. And I've seen this argument used repeatedly in the comment section of various Washington Post articles talking about the rural poor. And this is the problem. The idea, yeah, I'll just pack my bags and move, and that solves all the problem, you know, denies the level of inequality. If you were going to look at a map of America today, you could map it a whole class geography of where wealth is concentrated, where it doesn't exist. And this, you know, this is a reality that most Americans don't want to address.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the promises that this president has made and what's going on in the presidency. It's early, but what's going on now? You in the book tell this story, and I'm going to briefly tell it because it's a good one. And it's an 1840 story of the Arkansas traveler, a politician who's campaigning for office, stops in the back country. He asks a squatter for refreshment. The squatter had to be wooed for his vote. Had no patience for a candidate who refused to speak his language. So the man dismounts his horse, he takes the squatter's fiddle, and shows that he can play his kind of music. Once the politician returned to the mansion, nothing had changed in the life of the squatter. Trump, you say, has shown that he knows how to play the fiddle. What's going to happen to the squatters, Nancy?
Yeah, I mean, this is the sad promise of democracy, is that candidates can pretend, this is that idea, said, can pretend to be one of us, dress like us. Why do you think the candidates all have to go to Iowa and eat corn dogs and wear plaid shirts?
Right.
I mean, and voters accept this for some reason, and it's across the board. Who, you know, everyone buys into this, that somehow this means we can trust them when they pretend to be like us, when in fact we know they're nothing like us. Most of them are millionaires, you know, get elected to office, high office today. And they're not in any way necessarily speaking from experience. And I think the sad thing is that we've seen already that, you know, Trump's first budget is going to hurt the people, particularly rural Americans, in a very serious way. I mean, they want to cut the Appalachian Regional Commission, the Delta Regional Authority, community block grants, and the, you know, the health care bill was really horrendous. A writer in The Atlantic pointed out that already in America, rural areas are suffering, have created what are called health care and service deserts. And now this new health care proposal, the one that failed, was going to make coverage deserts. And what that means is, there's an article recently in the Washington Post about how all these hospitals in rural areas are closing down. This is part of the problem, is that Americans, throughout this entire campaign, Trump was never forced to be pinned down on exactly what policies he stood for, what would be the outcome of policies. He claimed that he was just going to make he was going to repeal Obamacare, and what he was going to introduce was going to be great, and everyone was going to be covered. Well, it's not true. And, this is where I also sort of hold journalists' feet to the fire, that they didn't demand, make him say what exactly he is going to support, what are his positions. But it also points to the fact that when we're in the midst of a campaign, it's a form of entertainment. It's a sporting event. And essentially, people are caught up in that emotional, very psychologically powerful moment of why they choose one candidate over the other.
Mm-hmm. So was,
and they're not making a rational choice.
Yeah. So,
and I think,
from what you just said, yeah, he was able then to fake his deep concern about these people whose lives were horrible, and that he was also able to fool a lot of people, which may indicate that people are so bad off that they are just grasping at somebody who's able to fool them.
Well, see, again, I won't say it's fool, because I think even very intelligent people behave irrationally during elections. I mean, the things that they care about, if what we are supposed to care about when we see a candidate is what they look like, what they sound at like. I mean, think of how Hillary Clinton was raked over the coals because she wasn't charismatic enough. We don't care whether they're real problem solvers. We have this problem where the campaigner is the entertainer, and then suddenly we expect them to be statesmen or stateswomen when they hold office. Those two things are not related at all, but we think they are. This is part of the problem. I mean, I think people responded to him, as I said, because he was the anti-politician. They responded to him because they could understand what he was saying. He speaks in very short, direct, sentences that aren't complicated. They felt he wasn't talking down to them. And there was a lot of, anger being directed at his voters. They were referred to as white trash. There was a lot of hostility. And I think that, that's why the media made such a big deal out of Hillary Clinton's basket of deplorables comment. That became fodder.
Oh, yes. Right.
And we know that campaigns are all about, emphasizing the differences, and in this case, the differences that were being constructed between these two Americas, between the Clinton Democrats and the Trump Republicans. And it really did. It's all about identity politics. It's basically, as I also highlight in my preface, it's about the way the metaphors of class took on a much bigger meaning, where Clinton Democrats were seen as pedigreed elites. The Trump Republicans saw themselves as disinherited. You have the cosmopolitan versus the provincial, the professionals versus the working stiffs, meritocracy versus hard work, faith in upward mobility versus fear of losing class status. Those are the things that sink in and make people feel like, okay, I'm not part of the Clinton world. My kids aren't going to college. And in fact, only 32.5% of Americans today graduate college. So there's a real gulf. There's a big, serious class gulf in this country, and politicians exploit that. And I think Trump did this both consciously and unconsciously, as we well know. He had no experience as being a politician. He just said what he thought.
Right.
That's why he made, endless numbers of errors. But no one cared, because all they cared about was his personality. And that's, unfortunately, what drives American politics, and especially because we invest so much in the presidential election that we somehow think, oh, this person is going to magically rescue the country.
Our guest this hour is the author of White Trash, the 400-year untold story Untold History, rather, of Class in America. Nancy Eisenberg is with us, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for her. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Nancy is also the author of Fallen Founder, The Life of Aaron Burr, and co-author of Madison and Jefferson. She is a professor in American history at LSU and writes regularly for Salon. This is the Ideas Network. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The Washington Post did an article recently and had conducted a survey not that long from when Trump was inaugurated, asking people maybe a month or month and a half, since his inauguration, asking what they thought about him and trying to discern if they, if people had lost their support for this president. They found that only 3% of Trump voters were expressing dissatisfaction. People were saying things like, keep up the good work, continue draining the swamp to bring America back to her greatness. That was a common refrain from many who support Donald Trump. So he's been in office for a while now. We're seeing this huge international bombing campaign that's going on that is costing millions of dollars and is happening very, very quickly. When you look at where the Trump administration has been since they've been inaugurated, all those promises of making America great again, all those promises to people to bring coal jobs back, to make their lives great again, why is there such a disconnect between what's happening in the administration and how people think he's doing a great job who voted for him?
Well, as I said, one of the problems is that, you know, voters often are not aware of what government policies actually benefit them. This is what political scientists and sociologists have found over and over again. I think most of the people who probably answered this survey, you know, who voted for Trump, you know, they basically feel they need to have their vote ratified. Many of them have also said, we'll wait and see. But once you've, you know, made that commitment to vote for someone, you're going to defend that person. And it's going to take a lot for you to change your opinion and suddenly, you know, decide that this candidate really doesn't reflect your interests and really isn't passing, you know, supporting policies that help you. I mean, I think that's part of the problem. I mean, when they do the interviews, they should say, well, list exactly what Donald Trump has done. What policies has he backed that are helping you? And when they just say drain the swamp, what does that mean? Who do they want to get rid of? And I think this is where I get back to the policy of how he tapped into this class animosity of viewing the Obama and Clinton and the Democrats as representing pedigreed elites. Because even Joe Biden mentioned this. He sort of said that the Democrats were, you know, placing too much emphasis on pedigree, and he meant class pedigree, and the world of meritocracy, where the talented 10th are people who go to the Ivy Leagues, and that this is the way the world should operate. And I think that that resentment, that kind of elitism that's associated with the Ivy League and the cognitive elite, was then transferred onto Washington. Mm-hmm. So draining the swamp is both draining the Democrats, draining the bleeding heart liberals, draining the people who somehow are perceived as working for the interests of other people, whether it's, you know, their fear of immigrants or somehow not working for their interest and how they define themselves. And that, you know, that metaphor, as I said, is very old. It's been exploited by politicians since Andrew Jackson.
Let's go to phone calls for you. We start with Cindy in Fox Cities. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Well, you talk about the class warfare, but I'm wondering if you've addressed the warfare on the coloreds, which has been propagating since Nixon, mostly I'm thinking, I'm losing my train of thought here. But anyway, I saw the documentary last night called 13th, which is based on the 13th Amendment. And I would hope that everybody would watch it, especially the people of color, because to see what has been going on and what is going to continue to go on if they voted for Trump, I think they would really, really wish that they hadn't.
Yeah, I talk about that a lot because one of the, as I said, I start with the British colonization and the way in which indentured servitude actually influenced slavery because it again, how was slavery first defined? The first Virginia law upholding slavery highlighted that a slave is a child born of a slave woman. It's about pedigree. It's about breeding. So, yes, and then I talk about Georgia. Believe it or not, Georgia was one of the few colonies that outlawed slavery. And why was it outlawed? Because it was argued that slavery makes it impossible for a poor white man to make a living. Now, again, I'm talking about the 1700s. And, yes, it was, you know, we're not talking about an open liberal viewpoint, but they recognized what became a reality that influenced the economy in the South. Why is it that the planter elite were also large landowners and large slave owners because they had a monopoly on land, they had a monopoly on wealth, and slavery contributed to that. And that's one of the things we have to recognize is that rural societies do not actually promote social mobility. Social mobility comes from commercial societies. There was more mobility in Great Britain in the 1800s than in America. So this is one of the things, yes, I deal with it again and again, the way in which slavery interacts and racism interacts with our class system. I talk about Reconstruction. Reconstruction, it was assumed that when the Republicans and the Union officers established the Freedmen's Bureau, that was also meant to help poor white refugees. And when they imagined rebuilding the South and making it an economy that would be more like the North, they assumed that it was the two lowest groups in society which were going to be measured and seen who's going to rise to the top first. Is it going to be the freed slaves or is it going to be the poor whites? And that's one of the things I try to highlight in my book is that there's a long history of really ugly, nasty terms for the people who are considered poor rural whites. There is an ugliness to the class system that we often erase, an ugliness that's comparable to the ugliness of the slave system. And this is part of what, unfortunately, economies do. Not only do they pick poor whites and poor blacks, as Andrew Johnson did, and also was exploited by the racist demagogues like James Vorderman, who I write about, who became powerful in places like Mississippi at the turn of the 20th century. But we also have to realize that class and race are always intertwined. Even racism, usually the people who are targeted are going to be poor blacks. So we have to constantly understand the relationship between these two forms of exploitation. But we also have to realize that we have to take class seriously, too, and understand how that operates, that it's not always race. It can be race and class, and sometimes it can be class. And I also write about gender, and that's also a factor. Particularly when I talk about the reproduction of class and the way women in the 19th century into the 20th century are seen as a measure of one's class identity. This is the real world, and it's ugly. Our past has a lot of things that we need to understand.
There have been times during our lifetimes or a little before when there was attention and serious attention paid to these issues of class and race. I'm thinking of James Agee's wonderful book, Let Us Now Pray for These Famous Men. I'm thinking about the very privileged Bobby Kennedy who visited very poor areas in New York and in the South and who seemed to be genuinely moved and talked poetically about what he saw and what needed to be done. There was Lyndon Johnson, who grew up poor in Texas and had a great society program. Why is it that there are certain moments in history where people tend to be genuinely concerned, heartfelt concern about some of the issues that we're all of a sudden realizing now exist and wanting to do something about it? This whole thing came as a surprise to many people, this whole election. Well, here are these people who are hurting, who are rural Americans, who are white voters, who are having very difficult lives. Surprise, surprise, we didn't even know they were there.
Right. Now, I think there is this problem of amnesia. We have historical amnesia. And I think you're right, there have been really important people. I mean, I think of Jane Addams,
Yes.
And the Settlement House movement. I talk a lot about LBJ. He's such an interesting and contradictory character. But the Great Society was aimed to help poor Appalachian whites and poor African Americans in the city. And I think the other thing I highlight is that even when poor Appalachians and poor whites moved into northern cities, they were denigrated with the same kind of hostility that was used against poor blacks. And I think you're right. The 30s, I have a, you know, the 30s is the one moment where I really feel, because you have a quarter of the population out of work, you can't just rationalize poverty anymore. You can't say, oh, work hard and you'll get ahead.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just say, you know, all the rationales that we constantly kind of rely on to sort of rationalize inequality. It didn't work in the 30s anymore. And that's why you have this flowering, this intellectual flowering. We have these people who really speak more directly to the problem of the rural poor. This is why FDR and the people in his administration, you know, were the first to really think about, well, how does the class system get structured? What can we actually do to change the class system? And they changed the vocabulary. But unfortunately, like everything else in America, we lose sight of that. And, you know, we had, as I also point out, you know, we really didn't have a stable middle class in this country until after World War II, because of the government, because of the federal government making it possible for people to get loans, to buy homes, to get an education. So this is the other side. You know, we lash out against the federal government, but we would not have a middle class without the federal government.
Let's go
one of the things that we need to remember.
Let's go to Holly in Madison. Hi, Holly.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm really fascinated by this subject, and I'm very much looking forward to reading the book, White Trash. But my question is, the author commented that historically there has been perhaps an elite sort of response to the plight of the people that live in the rural part of our country, well, just move, you know, as if that's kind of a throwaway, that's just obvious to us that that's what they should do. But here's my question. My sense is, in what I know of history of our country, is that we kind of always have moved if we needed a job. That it's apparent in our modern society that unless you're farming the land out there, there really isn't a lot of constructive employment, and maybe that will change, you know, I don't know, but at this point, is it really rude or inappropriate to say you need to move?
Well, I just think it's more complicated. I think we have to realize, for example, this is an argument that's often been used against Appalachia and people who live there, but you have to understand people who live in communities have family ties, have connections, have a support network, and to just, you know, the assumption that you just pack your bags and leave doesn't necessarily solve your problems. And that's why I go back to Jefferson and Franklin. Simply that you move and relocate doesn't mean you're going to make it wherever you move. And then you can run into other difficulties. I mean, this is one of the things that Americans constantly talk about at the turn of the 20th century, where we finally became more Americans were urban rather than rural. And they talk about the tensions, the difficulties people had when they moved to the city. And the fact is, there are many things we can do as a society to make that transition easier. And during the New Deal, you know, one of the solutions of Eleanor Roosevelt was to bring jobs to people in Appalachia, to set up a furniture store that was going to make furniture, find employment, it would provide them with employment, they would make furniture that was going to be sold to the post office, and then Congress shot down this solution. So that's the other thing. We know in our society that many companies are given tax breaks, given perks. And I think part of what we have to think about is, instead of this big divide between urban America and rural America, we have to find a way to make economic bridges. And we have to find ways to not just assume these people are isolated and too far from civilization, which is the old language, but we still use it, but to find a way, since we are a advanced technology, we have people who have virtual jobs. You're telling me you can't really find a way to create economic ties between wealthy areas in this country and poor areas in this country. But the caller is exactly right. The idea of bringing back coal or clean coal, going to old models, is not necessarily the best solution.
Holly, thanks very much for your call. We'll continue taking calls in a moment. Nancy Eisenberg is our guest this hour. Her book is now in paperback, White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We'd like to read your comments there. And we'll continue with all of this in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Next caller is Claire in Madison. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Kathleen. What a great guest. This book sounds great. I can't wait to buy it. Sounds great.
Good. Yeah.
Thank you.
Ben Carson famously said, poverty is a choice. And I could not disagree with that more. Poverty is not a choice. It's a trap. And why do politicians like Donald Trump have to create hate about certain groups of other people and then fear that comes with that hate in order to win? Why do we have to be judging massive groups of people and pit them against each other? What is that all about? Is that about each of us trying to make our little own selves feel better?
Nancy, interesting question.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I have a quote in my new preface which directly addresses that issue. This is from someone who wrote in 1924 who said, American voters prefer to cherish the unrealities they have absorbed based upon the primal instinct to defeat the side they hate or fear. Unfortunately, it's part of partisan politics is to hate the enemy, but then it goes beyond that. This is unfortunately one of the sides, one of the parts of American society and American democratic politics, is that hate is something that politicians often use because it's visceral. It taps into people's basic fears. It exploits whether it's racism or it's classism or whatever group that you can target as the other, proves to be a really effective strategy, and that's why politicians constantly do it. Because it's about dividing the America between the real Americans and then somehow the less real Americans. And this is something that was, you know, used during periods of, you know, nativist politics. It's something that was used against Native Americans. It's something that's been used in the South and elsewhere, pitting white against black. And, you know, this unfortunately is something that isn't going to go away. Because, as I said, if we can have an electorate who really understands their interests, understands the policies, and aren't just reacting emotionally and voting with their gut, you know, at a basic level, hate is always going to be used, and it's going to be exploited, and it's going to be something that can, in a sense, get people to think that their life is about battling other people. And I read another book recently which talks about how comparison is essential to upholding inequality in this country, that we're always comparing ourselves. Where are we on the ladder? Who belongs to be ahead of us? Who doesn't belong to be ahead of us? This is something else that I think was very effectively exploited during the last campaign.
Thank you, Claire, so much for your call. Fred in Hayward, hi.
Hello?
Yes, Fred, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I want to sit there and bring up the Native people that have really been murdered and raped and forced off of their original land. I want to sit there and talk about race. And how the farther you go from southern Wisconsin to northern Wisconsin, the more prolific the racism is. And I don't know what the answer is for white supremacy. But right now, if I was going to comment on the last hour, if I could get a part-time job, I would get it. But I don't want to support this government.
Do you see a fair amount of racism? I mean, this is something that was endlessly discussed for the Trump campaign. If you were a Trump voter, people were parsing whether or not you had to include an element of racism in your own vote because of what Donald Trump said, or if that could be taken apart from what your vote was. It was a totally separate issue. You want to discuss that, Nancy?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can't underestimate how much race has defined this country, how it is used by politicians. As I said, in the 19th century, I mean, one of the chapters I have in my book, some of the most intense racism was in the 19th century in this country. And the racism was used to attack Mexicans. It was used to justify the Mexican War. There was, you know, fears after that war of how do we, you know, how are we going to incorporate these people from Mexico that were attacked viciously in the same way that Native Americans were viciously attacked. So we have always had this problem of who do we decide, who has inherited this country? Who somehow is this country supposed to benefit? And we have had Supreme Court justices who have argued in the 19th century in the Dred Scott case, who argued, yes, well, this country belongs to white Americans who are descendants of the founding generation. So you can't escape racism. My point is that we have to understand that race and class are connected, and that we have to understand that there's an equally dismissive way of talking about poor whites, rural whites, and ignoring them, that also has a very long history. So we have to pay attention to that as well.
Fred, thanks. Let's go to Lila in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Oh, hi, Nancy. It also has a very long history. So we have
to turn the radio down, Lila.
Well. Okay, yeah.
Lila.
Hi.
There we go. Hi.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Lila, we can't hear you. I'll put you on hold. You got to turn your radio down, or we just can't hear at all. Don in Green Bay, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. There's just basically two points I'd like to raise. One is that in urban areas, there's a history of gentrification where you actually target a lower social economic community and you relocate them or actually dislocate them from their community where all their friends' relationships are. And you move in a higher socioeconomic class into that community, too. That's been going on for years. And the other thing has to do with, you mentioned before, with the Native American community on reservations. The government had a history of relocation where they actually moved Native Americans from the reservation and their communities into urban areas where there was no community that they essentially related to. So we've had a history of moving lower socioeconomic or cultural differently, different people out of the way of economics in the country.
Go ahead, Nancy.
I would just say that's even older, because that's basically about Western migration. I mean, one of the chapters I deal with is that many landless people who were called squatters and crackers headed out to occupy land they didn't have title to. And then when the large landowners came, they could force them off the land, push them, and the solution was keep moving. And you're exactly right. We have always had these policies in which the poor don't have the same rights. They don't, and I use this to attack the mythology of the pioneers, somehow the brave pioneers who moved west and were able to start a new life and everything became perfect. No, it's not true. Class inequality followed Americans as they moved west. In addition, as you point out, that you have a very tangled and you know, history with how poor whites were used in the battle against Native Americans. It was assumed in the Seminole War. This is when this is sort of in the late 18-teens, one of the first wars that was seen very much as a squatter war. It became a rationale that one way to defeat Native Americans was to give poor whites food, ammunition, and they would help clear out the Native Americans. And this was an accepted British policy and American policy. Mm.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye, Nancy. We're plumb out of time. Thank you so much for being with us and for writing the book. Thanks.
Well, thank you for having me.
Nancy Eisenberg, the book is White Trash, the 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. She's also the author of other books as well, including a book on Madison and Jefferson and also one on the life of Aaron Burr. Thanks to Colleen Duvall for producing this hour and to Colleen as well for on-air production. She is leaving us today. She's been here several months and many of you have spoken with her on the phone, done great production work too. So we wish her well in her further endeavors. And thank you for listening and for all of your calls. All Things Political with Joan Walsh, our guest on Monday. It's the next time we'll talk at 1 o'clock.